Hi, this is Jennifer Hellgren, Chair of the History Department at the University of the Pacific, and I'm here with Victor Ornelas doing an oral history interview about his experiences as a student in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Victor was a history major. He's a Pacific alumni who graduated in the fall of 1970 and began graduate classes in the spring of 1971. Mm-hmm. At Pacific, he was the chairman and founding member of Mecha, a football player, and then in 2002, he became a regent of the University of the Pacific. So, Victor, would you talk a little bit about your youth? Did you grow up in San Rafael, California? What was it like in the 1950s and 1960s? And then our next question will be more Pacific specific.
I grew up in South San Francisco, California. My earliest recollection was my family moved when I was three from Wichita, Kansas, where I was born, first to San Diego, because my dad was in the Marine Corps Reserve, and when the Korean War broke out, he was called up to active duty. He was stationed first in San Diego, and when he learned that he was going to be stationed there for the duration of the war, he packed up my mom and myself and my brother, who was probably 9 months old at the time, because he's a year and a half younger than I am, and we drove out to San Diego. And then after the war ended, we moved north to San Francisco, where my mother had her family. The many members of her family had moved there from Indianapolis, Indiana. So that's where we sat down and set our roots. And then I remember my earliest memory of our home was we lived in some what they called military projects. They're housing built for veterans of the war and of the World War II and then the Korean War. And naval projects, and so military personnel could live there, pay, a reduced rent, I'm sure. And we were there till I turned five, and then when I turned five, they purchased their first and only home, and they still own, my mom owns the home now that my dad's gone, but in South San Francisco, that's where I grew up. Do you want me to go on, or
you can talk just a little bit about high school. I do have some yearbook photos that have been collected by ancestry.com. You're not actually in the yearbook except for one team photo of the football team.
Oh, the
to get to University of Pacific. So I have your senior photo and your senior football photo from high school.
Really?
Yeah, I'll send those to you too.
I do have my yearbook if you want to see it. So, growing up in South San Francisco, went to local schools, played sports, started being really interested in sports at an early age. Willie Mays, who's still alive, was my favorite baseball player of all time. He played for the San Francisco Giants. And so I played baseball, I played football, and then when I got to high school, I also wrestled. So I participated in those three sports, and then was all conference in football, all league, all county, and then all league in baseball. And then in wrestling, I did win my weight championship my junior year. I didn't wrestle my senior year because of a football injury. Didn't get recruited by any of the colleges or universities in California to play football, but I really wanted to play football in college. So I walked on at University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, my freshman year, 66 to 67. Had a great experience and learned a lot, but wasn't offered a scholarship and didn't think I would be offered one. So then I went back to College of San Mateo. Okay. And when I got there, I actually visited there during the spring before the spring semester. I was out at UCLA, which was my last semester there, my first year, my freshman year. And when I reached out to talk to the football coaches there, they were very pleased that I was coming to back to San Mateo. And they said, while we can't guarantee you anything, we definitely look forward to you trying out for the team and playing. And I did end up starting, and I was one of the captains. I was definitely defensive captain, made all conference. And after my fall semester, Doug Scoble, who was the head coach of football at University of Pacific at the time, was down on a recruitment trip, and we met, we talked. At the time, because of the NC2A regulations, if you left a four-year school, you had to sit out a year before you could go on to another four-year school, a full year now. So that meant that I would have to wait till the following fall. And so I couldn't, before I could go to Pacific and go and on a football scholarship. Well, they changed that rule, fortunately for me, in the early 1968 at the NC2A convention. So then, as soon as they changed it, I actually was being recruited by Pacific and San Jose State.
Okay.
And the head coach of San Jose State called me and said, I have great news. They just changed the regulation, and we want to invite you to come down. We have a full ride scholarship in your name, and we'd love for you to join us. I said, fabulous. Can I call you back? And you know, San Jose State was a great option, but I felt like it was more of a, more like going to junior college, because it's such an urban school and it's right near my home. And I had a lot of friends at Pacific that I went to school with. There was, I think, five of us that came from my high school and ended up at Pacific playing football.
Nice.
So, and then one of my best friends, growing up and through high school, Mickey Ackley, was the quarterback. He was a quarterback at Pacific, and he transferred after his freshman year at San Mateo. His sophomore, he ended up at Pacific on a scholarship. So that was really an incentive, is to join, you know, my good friend and other friends and fellow classmates from El Camino at Pacific. So I called Scoble and told him that, you know, hey, I heard that they changed NC2A regulation. He didn't sound like he was very familiar with that. So I kind of broke the news. I said, well, I'm ready. And so thing I know, I packed up, you know, next day, my mom and I drove up because my dad couldn't get off work. And I wanted one of my parents along with me to help me make the decision, finalize the decision, and met with Doug, you know, Coach Scoble and some of the other coaches, and said, yep, they were ready to offer you a scholarship. And I went home, packed my stuff, and was in registering for classes on Monday, the following Monday. So that's where my whole Pacific experience started.
Yeah, well, that was the next question, was how you came to Pacific and what made you choose it. But that makes sense that you would come with football teammates and friends as well. So what was campus life like in the late 1960s and early 1970s?
Well, it seemed like we were a little bit of an island, to put it nicely. While the other schools, you know, and actually my first introduction to thinking about the war in Vietnam was I had a history class. His name escapes me right now, but a very famous and illustrious professor of history at UCLA. Mm-hmm. In that class in the fall of 66, just the first time that, you know, as the war in Vietnam was escalating, the first time that someone really presented an opposing point of view that we should not be there. Mm-hmm. And so that really kind of stimulated my thinking. And I started, and by, you know, 68, it was, and I had a very fairly low draft number. I was like about 115, and they were going to 130. And so I knew that as long as we had the 2S student deferment at that time. So I realized as long as I stayed in school, I was good. And I did have a friend that got drafted because he failed to stay in school. And so I didn't want to go over there, and I wanted to continue my education, and also, you know, I wanted to play football. So that was my So it's an interesting time because as the rest of the country is starting to really speak out against the war in 68, Pacific seemed to be fairly isolated and almost, what's the word? Not agnostic.
Apathetic.
Apathetic. Thank you. They seem to be fairly apathetic. And it was interesting. I was of fairly humble means, and most of the money that I used to live on, other than a little small allowance my folks would give me every week, for, to buy some stuff out of pocket stuff, most of the money that I had, for out of pocket expenses, other than my tuition was covered, the room, the dormitory was covered.
You lived on campus in the dorms?
On campus, yes. So that was all housing was covered, meals, the cafeteria were covered, but you still needed, you had book expenses and other things. And so that was from my own working during the summer, I saved for those. I saw a real dichotomy between, there was some very, very affluent students and there were some not very affluent students like myself who were working class. And they're on a scholarship, an athletic scholarship. So that was, and then we couldn't afford those, particularly most of the football players were probably of more moderate means in households. And so we would participate in whatever activities we could find to participate on campus on the weekends. Well, there seemed to be like at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon or 4 o'clock, you'd see a steady stream of cars, nice cars driving with students away from the campus and probably going to the Bay Area or wherever else they might choose to go. So that was really interesting. But I love the small classes coming from UCLA, where we had very large classes. And I remember one class is 500 students, one lecture. Yeah. To classes where there's maybe 30 to 50 in a class, and I thought we had really outstanding professors, and what I like is the more intimate environment where you can really get to know not just your classmates but also your professor and have those kinds of interactions and conversations.
Yeah, I did my undergrad, by the way, at UCLA, and my first Western Civ history class, I think, had 700 people in it. Never got to know the professors till I was a senior.
Yeah, you'd have a TA, right? You'd have these discussion sessions with TAs.
Yeah. Many of whom became professors and part of my network, but I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. So what other activities were you involved in other than football early on? I think that I saw there was I don't know if you were a part of SAE, and then I found some references in newspapers, also a Peace Alliance. So I don't know if you were involved in those or if there were other things that you were involved in that you spent your time on.
Yeah, when I was at UCLA, they had a very robust fraternity and sorority system. It was like when they'd have rush, it was like Mardi Gras. There were these amazing parties at these houses. And so actually the SAEs wanted to rush me. They wanted me to join their fraternity. And that was in the spring of 67. And I had buddies that, I was in a dorm with that they were gonna join, their brothers were members. And they rushed me hard, but I knew that I probably wasn't going to stay. But I had such a great experience, attending their events and knowing members of the fraternity. So when I got to Pacific, when I arrived at Pacific, then we were actually housed in a former fraternity house. I'm forgetting the name of the fraternity, but you probably would know, or from your history, from what you found in the archives.
Yeah, I could look it up.
Yeah, they were banned. They were banned from campus. They were, their certification was terminated. And
interesting.
They did some, I don't know what they did, but we heard a lot about them. So we were, a lot of the football players were put in that my first semester on campus, I was in that house. And it was during that time that there was a movement to organize an SAE house.
Interesting.
And so I said, you know, and so I raised my hand, said, yeah, I went through the process and became a member. But at the same time, I had a really mixed feelings about fraternities and sororities. And then we had the cluster colleges over at, you know, on the other side of campus. So we had Callison, we had Covell, and just a Spanish speaking, Callison, I think Covell. Yeah, Albert Covell was a Spanish speaking, and Raymond.
And Raymond College.
And so decided that one of my fellow teammates, Tony Plummer, who we quickly became great friends, and we both were from San Mateo, from the San Mateo County. You know, he went to, I think he went to Sequoia, and then, but he had played at San Mateo Junior College, and I knew of him. He was illustrious. He was a great player. And so we just connected immediately when I met him on campus. So we both decided that we would, and I don't remember if he actually was going to rush. I went to kind of the ceremony, and then I decided not to join the fraternity full time. And Tony and I moved over to Raymond, one of the dormitories over there in that cluster college area. So that was in, that would have been the fall of 68.
It was an interesting time from what I can tell. The Pacific Alumni newsletter, they used to publish three times a year. It's either 69 or 70. One of the issues praises the fraternities for abandoning parades with Confederate flags. Like, the fraternities have stood up and said that this is no longer something that they think they should be doing. So it's a period of transition you can see in the fraternities and sororities as well, at least from what you can gather from the university publications.
Thank you. You just triggered a memory about that. And so it was, since there were not very many Latino students on campus, there were a group that was part of a program called, I think it was Teacher Corps.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and then what they did is provide scholarships because they're trying to help more Latinos get through, get their education, college education, so they go on and teach in, you know, high density Latino schools. And so, you know, other than, there was two of us on the football team, Bill Toledo and myself, only two Latinos on the football team. And, you know, Bill was a member of SAE. I think he stayed a member. And then I was a little bit more, I don't want to say liberal, activist oriented, and particularly around civil rights. And so as I felt I was more, I had more of a connection with the African-American football players. And so that, you know, I started hanging out with them, and we all kind of started gravitating towards that dormitory. I can't remember the name of it, over in the quadrangle. And so I remember there was one evening when the black ball players, well, and they were kind of the founders of the Black Student Union. So there's the members of the Black Student Union, led by many of the black football players, said that they were, that, which fraternity was it? Sorry, I can't remember exactly which fraternity, but they still had the Confederate flag flying above their house. And so I was invited to join this group of players, and we went over to the fraternity house to have a conversation with them about why it was in their best interest to take down the flag. And it was a pretty straightforward, I was just there observing and listening, but I was right there with them. I said, it's incredibly humiliating and shameful. And you know, and maybe their fraternity roots, but not something we felt they should be proud of. And so, yeah, it was a pretty tense situation. I mean, we literally walked into the fraternity house, and and said that we thought it was a good idea for them to take it down. I can't remember if they did take it down immediately. I think they did, and maybe posted it inside the house. But yeah, that's one of those memories.
Yeah, interesting. So were there, you mentioned that you were more politically or activist oriented. Were there early organizations? From what I could gather, MECHA was founded in 1970,
yeah.
But it came from another organization called CHE, which I had actually never heard of. Were you involved in those early on?
Yes.
Were you involved in the founding? What was that?
Well, as soon as I heard that there was some movement, and some of those other Latino students were on the teacher corps. Al Ortiz was a member. I can remember he was one of the leaders as well. I'm trying to remember some of the other names, but, you know, again, there's maybe about a dozen of us. And we start having kind of informal meetings and talking about, you know, we needed to organize. And MECHA was really starting to take root in campuses, you know, definitely in the West Coast. Outside in Texas, it was different. They had a different organization. I can't remember the name of it, but as I learned later. So yeah, we started talking about it. And I guess it was, you know, around 70 when we finally got organized.
You remember what were some specific inspirations? Were you looking for sense of camaraderie? Were you looking for an alternative to fraternities? I'm trying to gauge a little bit how politically active MECHA and the Black Student Union were at Pacific, because as you mentioned earlier, we do have this reputation for being rather apathetic in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what was interesting is we had a Spanish-speaking college on campus,
Cal State.
And there was a real, is the appropriate pronunciation schism or schism? Schism?
I think so.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Because my wife and I were thinking, is it schism or schism? Anyway, but
I've heard it both ways.
Yeah, there's definitely a divide, a division between, I felt, those of us that grew up in the U.S., born and raised there, versus these were Latin Americans coming from a lot of different countries, not just Latin Americans, but they're mostly Latin Americans. And it was, I think it was Robert Burns' goal was he was kind of the father of these cluster colleges, which are great. I mean, from the students I knew at Callison, they had an incredible education, you know, went to India their junior year. Raymond was, you know, kind of the university or college without walls. It was really kind of very avant-garde and ahead of its time. And then you had the Spanish-speaking college. But we always felt that those of us that were not students at Callison, that they were kind of very upper, there was a very class difference. They were very, coming from very upper-class Latin American families, and we were pretty much, you know, working-class Latinos, you know, and Mexican Americans primarily. And at the same time, Cesar Chavez was very active. You know, he launched the farm workers movement, and that was very active and robust. And I remember we joined the farm workers in boycotting some of the supermarkets that were selling at the time. It was lettuce, I think, was what they were having a major. The farm workers unions have major disagreement with the growers. And so they started boycotting, and we you know, stand out outside some stores to demonstrate and, you know, picket and encourage people, shoppers, not to purchase lettuce.
Yeah, there's a number of letters in the Pacific Weekly asking the food service to get involved in the boycott as well. And I think the students started a petition to get them to stop purchasing.
So I think that, you know, all this was happening, you know, and to me, the San Joaquin Valley was the epicenter of the Latino movement, with you know, led by Chavez and Dolores Huerta. In fact, I remember Dolores Huerta, if it wasn't shortly after we organized, or about the time we were organizing, coming to meet with us, the students that were, you know, the founders of MECHA, just to talk to us and of course to get our support.
Yeah, and of course she had gone through the junior college when it was part of Pacific as well.
Yeah, amazing woman.
So let's talk a little bit about the protests. I'm doing a little web history about different sites on campus, and Burns Tower is going to be one of them. And so from my understanding from the Pacific Weekly, and from the almost 100 Emeriti interviews that are also in our archives, and they don't all talk about the protests because they weren't all there, but a lot of them do. There was a student protest at Burns Tower led by Black Student Union, particularly John Stanton was president. And a lot of the Emeriti attribute the organizing to Reverend John Diamond, who was the first Black Studies director at Pacific, and also to Gwen Brown of philosophy. So I just saw that in one of the Emeriti interviews. I hadn't known that. This led to the establishment of the Community Involvement Program. My sense is that it was already in the works, and the Black Student Union said, no, you got to do this now. We're not waiting. We're not talking anymore. And so they had a number of demands. You spoke about this in a 2009 Alumni Magazine quote, which is how I actually identified you as somebody who really needed to be interviewed, besides being a student and a regent. So could you tell me a little bit more about this event from your perspective? What was the mood on campus at the time? What was your involvement? What other people were involved? Who were the movers? I doubt it was really faculty, but maybe it was.
I think we had some faculty support, as I recall. I can't remember exactly who, but I think we knew. I mean, we were in this lily white university, and it wasn't going to change unless we did something, you know, earth shattering, if you will, or something very, very impactful is the best word. And I know we were associated with it and aligned with it. I don't remember if we spoke. And this, when did the demonstration occur? What date?
Spring of 1969. March 25,
yep, 1969. Yep. So I remember being there. I don't think I was, you know, I wasn't a speaker, but I know I was there. And again, because I always felt that, what was I told? I was told by the Black Student Union members that because I was an African American, I couldn't be a member, but I could be an ally, I guess, or something like that. And so that meant a lot to me. I want to be one of the allies. So I was treated like one of their brothers. And so, you know, I was there observing. I remember John speaking. And I remember the university finally, yes, saying, yeah, we will do something. And as I recall, it wasn't just for people of color, students of color. It was for, which I thought was pretty visionary. They said it really is around income as well. So a certain income level that, you know, they would get scholarships. And so, of course, that was opening the door for not just African-Americans, but Latinos and even, you know, people of low income means of whatever race or ethnicity. And it's to this now, I believe just that the fact that I was associated in some way is one of my proudest moments of being a student at Pacific, that we mm-hmm. opened doors. And I don't know how many thousands have graduated since then. What's interesting is when I went back to grad school, I had a CIP fellowship.
Oh, did you?
Yes. So I was a beneficiary of it because I definitely couldn't afford to pay the tuition to go to grad school. And, you know, we were recently married. I registered for school. I didn't even know I'd applied for it and didn't know that I'd received it. And my wife and I, Marjorie, you know, student of graduate Pacific as well, we got married on Sunday, the 16th of September, 1973. On September 17th, I was standing in line getting registered for classes to do my master's in graduate school because they lost my, they didn't have forwarding information. So they called my parents like the week before I got married and said, I can't remember his name, but he was with the university and he said, Latino, he said, Victor, you know, we've been trying to find you. You applied for this fellowship and you've been awarded this fellowship for graduate school. I go, really? That's awesome. I go, okay, so what I need to do is, well, you know, you need to be here by Monday because you need to get registered for class. That's the deadline. I go, oh my God.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so fortunately we were pretty mobile by that at that time. So we packed up and then Marjorie ended up working for, in the dental school, the school of pharmacy. She okay. was like assistant to one of the administrators there. So mm-hmm. We actually benefited from it as well. It is an incredible program and an incredible move by the university to do that, to open the doors to so many students that would never have had the opportunity to get a college education without that support.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if there is a count. I'll have to look to see if they've counted how many of those fellowships they have given. I was also reading that Jose Hernandez was
an astronaut. He was on our board regents.
Okay. Yeah. And I haven't verified that he was CIP outside of just. Yes,
he was.
Okay, good.
Yeah. See, that's again, that's what happens when a university, you know, makes those bold steps.
Yeah. Yeah. The conversation around the CIP program at the time among faculty and administrators was interesting. I wonder if you can shed any light on this perspective. There was a worry that the students would not be prepared, that they would need some kind of remediation to be successful at Pacific. There were some 100 faculty who offered to teach an extra class without pay in order to make sure those students were brought up to speed if they needed it. In my experience as a professor at UOP, those are some of our best students. They don't need any remediation. So I'm curious, early on, was that a real issue, or was that just a concern and a kind of stereotype about students from the local area, low-income students?
My knowledge, it wasn't an issue. Yes, I mean, you take any student coming into university, you know, as a professor.
We all need some help getting.
I need help. Here's an example. My roommate, my freshman year at UCLA, came down. Dental school. Mm-hmm. He's dental pre-med, pre-med dental. And he was from Saratoga. You know where Saratoga is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very affluent community. And so we were roommates, but he had the intelligence. He just, in a big school like UCLA, where there's a lot of social activities, he flunked out his freshman year. Okay. Meanwhile, I hung in there. I was playing football. I was paying my own way. Now, I didn't get the best grades I've ever gotten, that's for sure. I think I was like a C+, but I was grateful that I managed that, that squeezed that out watching my roommate, because he took some very hard classes and he didn't have. So anyway, it doesn't matter. You know, it's really about, yeah, preparation is very important and very helpful, but we didn't have the kind of support that I believe that they have tutorial resources that, you know, that a university provides and colleges provide now.
Yeah.
So I think that, I remember some of the professors expressing that concern, but I said, well, there's many of us, you look at the Latinos that are on this campus, and we didn't come from wealthy backgrounds. My mother was a high school graduate. My father didn't get through sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
But I made it. I made it through school. I was always an honor student through school, and because I applied myself, and I was in, I had the encouragement and, yeah, you know, the moral support I needed. So,
yeah, tremendous program. Continues to be a tremendous program.
I don't recall that, but I think that was wonderful that they said, yeah, you know, if we have to, we'll do whatever we need to do to help these students succeed.
Yeah.
We'll donate some of our time. That's great.
Yeah, so there were some other programs that came out of those demands as well. So they launched the CIP. They also did a couple of institutes. They did a Black Studies Institute in the summer, which looked like a, you know, condensed course program open, I think, to Pacific students as well as to community members. And then I think they did a Mexican-American Studies program, well, institute and then program as well. They launched the Black Studies major. And then they launched this Mexican-American studies major as well. And we talked briefly on the phone about Miguel Navarrete, who was the one who was hired. Right around the time Robert Burns passed away, he was not rehired. And it looks like there was a second protest that the METCHA students were involved in. And you were quoted in the Pacific Weekly about those events. What was that like? What was the mood on campus just with these upsets around Mexican-American studies right at the same time that Robert Burns had died? Do you remember what that was like at the time?
Well, I remember definitely the Black Studies program being launched. I actually have a double major, history and Black Studies.
Okay.
I was so interested in the courses, and that was before we did, you know, launch the Mexican American Studies program. And I was very, I was involved in helping get that up and running, and supporting, and, you know, METCHA was supporting Miguel Navarrete and what he was doing. But it just seemed like as we started to get, again, my memories may be a little foggy and fuzzy, but as we started to get the program going, and he didn't even have a chance to get out of the chute when they shut it down, or they, you know, they terminated him. And I remember, was it Chambers? Was that the, no, not Chambers, Jansen. Mark Jansen was the dean. And I remember him having a conversation with him, but I was so naive and didn't really know what he was doing, but it was, he had some concerns about Miguel Navarrete's performance. And I said, so, and my best memory is that, well, what have you, you know, what discussions have you had with him? You know, what communication have you had, you know? And then I said, well, you know, and I guess we thought that he was gonna be put on some kind of probation or something, yeah. Something was gonna be written up. And then next thing we know, he gets terminated. And that did not make me look well, because then they thought that I was a part of that termination, and I agreed with it. I did not agree with it. And then we had quite an uproar over that. And I remember members of the community, yeah, it got pretty heated, very heated, just among our own members of our community. I remember one meeting in one of the conference rooms there, and you know, members of the community with, you know, oh God, what's his name? He was head of the high school equivalency program. Did your notes show?
No, I'd have to look it up. I don't know.
It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, the high school equivalency program was, again, another really interesting program that the university signed up for. And I was a tutor in that program the first year on campus. And then I came back and actually was the tutor supervisor when I was doing my graduate work. And the program was to federally funded to provide a GED education program for migrant workers' children.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they're going through high school, and many of them housed on campus in a separate dormitory, but they were actually, you know, again, it was they're completing their high school education. And so I had an opportunity to help out in terms of providing tutorial support, and then came back then as a supervising the tutors for that program.
Yeah, so that was another one of the programs that started, and then they also expanded the Teacher Corps program.
Yes.
After the 1969 protest, I think those were some of the main shifts. And again, it looked like, I mean, Burns is ready to move on a lot of this, which indicates that they had been talking for quite some time. And then they had a academic council meeting, and the academic council voted to approve it. And then they made a statement to the Stockton Record in 1969, which it says something like, which is March 26, 1969, which said something about the students asked for. So it really played down the protests, which was kind of interesting. So do you think at any one of these protests that there was the likelihood of violence? You said it got heated. I'm just trying to gauge, you know, how does Pacific compare to Berkeley?
close. And you know, San Francisco State.
Yeah, San Francisco State is.
I mean, there was some serious, you know, demonstrations that got very physical. So we had ours, but I wasn't at Berkeley. I know people that were there. I wasn't, and they got gassed. Mm-hmm. I wasn't at San Francisco State, but I know people that were there. We actually had some of those leaders come up and talk to us, you know, about what they did. And so give us pointers, as I recall. Yeah. But no, it wasn't to me nearly like that. It was, it never got out of hand.
Do you think part of that was because Burns was responsive?
Burns, and I think we had a lot of support from the faculty too. You know, I believe, you know, the professors I knew, I think they definitely were in alignment with us philosophically. So I think they saw that changes need to be made. I mean, you look around you. You see every other university, an institution, academic institution is changing and opening their doors, and they knew they were sitting in the San Joaquin County, which even then, you know, very high percentage of Latinos, very high percentage of Filipinos, fairly high percentage of African Americans. So it was truly a quote melting pot community. So the university always stood out as this ivory tower. You know, a truly white ivory tower institution. There was almost, you know, the vast majority of the students there were Anglo, white, and we need to represent the community we lived in beyond those economic restraints.
Yeah. So were there particular faculty that you remember that you'd like to name that were supportive? Or was it just a general sense that many were supportive?
I think they're more morally, Larry Meredith.
Okay.
Larry Meredith, I believe, was very supportive. And example, and you probably already know this, but look at some of the leaders like,
Angela Davis?
Angela Davis, she spoke. We had.
Corky Gonzalez also spoke. Yes. Timothy Leary, Angela Davis.
Yeah, I remember Corky very vividly because then I think I was the leader, I met you that, and we talked about it. So we had several of the Latino leaders at the time, come up. Yeah, Corky was awesome. And then I remember Metcha had a meeting just with him and just to talk about what he was doing. Through things like that, those kinds of forums, and again, Larry Meredith, you know, but I believe there's others, some of the professors, I can't remember all their names now, but were if not vocally supportive, they were, you know, we knew that they were in alignment with what our goals were, which is to integrate the campus, you know, to become, you know, diversity, you know, way before it's time, before people are talking about diversity, we have this opportunity to be a very diverse campus. So.
Yeah. So I looked at your transcripts because I know you're interested in coming back and finishing up the MA. And I saw that in your last year at Pacific, you did take classes like Negro and American Literature, History of the American Negro. Obviously, these are phrases we wouldn't use today, but the class would be the same. Prejudice and Racism, which my good friend Marcia Hernandez still teaches. Oh, Oriental Culture and History, Cultural Contributions of Black Americans. And then there was one, Chicano and Anglo History, actually Chicano e Anglo History. And so I was surprised that there were that many offerings. I mean, we're lucky sometimes still now to be able to offer that array of ethnic studies classes. So were those classes that began to be offered while you were there? Were they, do you remember anything about how they came to be part of the curriculum and what they were like?
Yeah, right at the end, because that's how I got a major. I focused on all those classes because I had enough units in my other, I completed all my other requirements. So yeah, that's my passion, my interest. And so that's why I signed up. And then lo and behold, I ended up getting a double major. And a few units to get into a second major.
Okay. So in what ways have you stayed connected to Pacific over the years? I know you were on the Board of Regents. How did you come to be on the Regents? Had you been connected that whole time? And what kinds of goals did you have as a regent?
Great question. Questions. I wish I could say I had been connected, but I hadn't been after I graduated. And then up until really, it kind of started with our eldest son, Dan, had applied to Pacific, and he applied to, I think it was George Washington in DC, as well as Boston College. But he also wanted to play football as well. And he wasn't recruited or get a scholarship coming out of, he played for a Catholic boys' school now that's, you know, the highest classification in sports, but back then they weren't. They were in the, I think they might have even been in the you know, private school league. And so when we went to look at the colleges, and we particularly Boston College, which is a, you know, legendary football program. And they said, well, we'd love for you to come out, you know, we'll redshirt you. They, you know, from a financial perspective, they love redshirts because, you know, they get some free labor, you know, tackling dummies for the varsity or for the, you know, the people that have scholarships. So, and when he said, I said, he applied to Pacific. I said, well, I go, if you want to walk on, the one advantage you would have is I know the athletic director, Bob Lee, who had played at Pacific. His quarterback ended up having a illustrious career in the NFL. And so, and Bob was, I don't know if he was supposed to be an interim athletic director, but he ended up as athletic director, you know, when was that? That would have been early 90s. Yeah, like 91, 92 to, I think 95, well, till they did away with football. So Dan went out to Pacific, and then, you know, I remember, you know, talking to Bob about it, let him know he was coming out. He says, well, you know, give him a good look. And so he played, well, freshman, I think they maybe played a couple, three games. They mostly scrimmaged with the varsity. So then my affiliation with the university started coming back because my son was there.
Okay.
Son was there. So, you know, I kind of got back on campus. I kind of reconnected with a few people. And then, it was 94. So yeah, so it was like a year later. And I think Don was in his first, what was Don's first year at as president of Pacific?
Oh gosh, I don't have that written down. I'd have to
look right, 93, 94, right around then. Well, this, you know.
It had to be.
Yeah, and I had this Latino advertising agency. We'd started in 90, and 94, somebody nominated me, and it was Aflac had the sponsorship with Hispanic Business Magazine for the annual Hispanic Entrepreneur of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And so some woman was calling on us from Aflac, local sales rep. And when she met with us and she learned about what we were doing, and we were one of the first Latino advertising agencies in the country, particularly one of the first to be started by a US-born Latino.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other agencies, particularly in New York and one or two in the LA that were started by Cuban immigrants,
mm-hmm.
been in advertising industry in Cuba or in Mexico. So I was kind of one of the first, if not the first, native-born Latino. And I actually, the only reason I got into that is because I was fortunate when Anheuser-Busch launched their first Hispanic marketing program, they hired me they started like pilot programs. They started one in California with a Latino that they already had, who was one of their sales execs, and they asked him to take on creating this program. He did in LA and California, and it started to do well, and they got, you know, all the support from the wholesalers. It was a no-brainer. You know, they said, we know Latinos drink a lot of beer, and there's a lot of them in LA and Southern and California. And so Texas became the next target state, and particularly the guy that was the number two to August Bush at the time, Denny Long, he and August had this, like, they created this target states program where they would go into states where they had high potential to increase volume and share of market with the Anheuser-Busch products. So the first two markets were California and Texas, which were also the two biggest beer drinking states. Mm-hmm. So Denny had Texas and August had California. And I don't know if it's true, but I always heard that there was this little bet going on between the two of them, who was going to increase the business fastest. And so I was fortunate that a colleague that we had worked at together at Levi Strauss ended up working in a corporate relations position targeting the Latino organizations in the US to start to build relationships with those organizations. There's a government relations, corporate relations job, Jesse Aguirre, and we had worked together at Levi's. So when Joe Martino, who was the number two guy to Denny Long at the brewery, was looking for someone to put in Texas, they didn't have anybody they could promote within the ranks. And so he went to Jesse and said, Jesse, do you know anybody that we can recruit for this position? He goes, yeah, I know some guy, Victor Ornelas, who works for Levi Strauss. So Jesse calls me. This is in fall of 82. And Jesse calls me and says, you're going to get a call from a guy named Joe Martino at Anheuser-Busch. And I go, why is he calling me? And he goes, he wants to talk to you about a job. I go, what job? And he goes, to build a Hispanic marketing program in Texas. I go, I'm in corporate contributions and corporate affairs. I don't know anything about marketing. I don't have an MBA. He goes, don't worry, they'll train you. And I go, okay. So Joe called me. I flew in for an interview. He offered me a job on the site. And then I ended up in building this program in Texas, and it took off. We had tremendous wholesaler support. Anyway, I'll cut it short. But that led to me then seeing that there were no agencies. I mean, I was pretty much, we had this agency out of New York, whose founder was originally from Cuba, but they knew nothing about Mexican Americans, number one, the largest segment. Number two is they didn't know, I got a 2:00. So I'm so sorry. Okay. I'll cut short. So anyway, I end up starting this agency. I said, there are very few agencies. So. And then lo and behold, after 4 years, we had a pretty good run, and this magazine selected us as Hispanic Entrepreneur of the Year.
Yeah.
He is Hispanic Entrepreneur of the Year. And that's where then one of my fellow alums, sent an article from the Dallas Morning News newspaper back to the Pacific, and Don saw it, and he came down here. He was visiting, and then he's the one that then we the relationship started. And they kind of wooed me back to the university and asked if I'd serve on the Board of Regents.
Thanks. And then do you have time just to mention one or two of the goals that you had as a regent? What made you want to do that, actually?
Continue to raise the bar for the university. Mm-hmm. You know, and I learned that the university had gone through major transformation. Well, the first thing was, you know, Don's, and you may have heard about this, but Don, the university was in serious financial straits.
Yeah.
And then they had to discontinue football. And I'm one of the few that was okay with that.
Okay.
Football players, they still, many of them hold a grudge about that. I said, they had to make a financial decision. They had to do it. And so, yeah, I think one of the goals is first and foremost, let's continue to support Don in turning the university financially around, you know, and then continue to raise the bar in terms of programs. And I remember Mark, I can't remember his last name, the Dean of Law School. And he invited me to come speak there. And I, you know, just, you know, humbly share that, you know, there's so much I learned in retrospect and reflection after I thought back about some of those great experiences I had at Pacific. It was a great academic experience, some great professors. And you, I learned some of those, the experiences we've been talking about were so much a part of my education too.
Yeah. So. Well, I better let you go since you have another meeting.
I should let you know ahead of time.
It's maybe that we need to set up another one just to talk about regent issues at some point.
Absolutely. You tell me when you want to reschedule. My schedule next week is really good. I don't know what yours is like.
But... I'm actually going to be traveling and having kids' spring break for the next couple of weeks. So I'll reach out via email. But I so appreciate your time. And I'll send you a transcript of all of this so you have it for your reference.
Thank you for bringing all this back. I mean, it's like, boom, boom, boom. It's like, Jennifer, I know you, we all say this from time to time, but it seems like yesterday. As we're talking about it, it seems like I was right there at Burns Tower, you know, and then in the midst of all this chaos. But it was, I never regret any minute of it. It was just, that was all part of the learning experience.
Yeah. And well, we appreciate what you did too.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Have a good one.